Whether eating, taking drugs, engaging in sex, or doing good deeds, the pursuit of pleasure is a central drive of the human animal. In The Compass of Pleasure, Johns Hopkins neuroscientist David Linden explains how pleasure affects us at the most fundamental level in our brain. As he did in his book, The Accidental Mind, Linden combines science with anecdotes to illuminate the source of the behaviors that can lead us to ecstasy, but can easily become compulsive. Why are drugs like nicotine and heroin addictive while LSD is not? Why has the search for safe appetite suppressants been such a disappointment? The Compass of Pleasure concludes with a consideration of pleasure in the future, when it may be possible to activate our pleasure circuits at will and in entirely novel patterns. Dr. David Linden joins us this morning on The Roundtable. Doctor, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate your time, and this book is endlessly fascinating and very entertaining as well. What got you thinking about it in these terms of our pleasure compass?
Well, I think what led me to that was the realization that we have a evolutionarily ancient pleasure center in our brain that uses the neurotransmitter dopamine. We call it the medial forebrain pleasure circuit. And that it's activated not just by our vices like food and sex and gambling, but also by our virtuous prosocial behaviors like exercise and meditation and learning and charitable giving. So the notion of the compass is that pleasure is our compass no matter the path we take.
When we are engaging in these activities, how conscious and how subconscious is that level of pleasure, in the sense of when we engage, do we do it because of the pleasure?
Well, so that's a great question. And the answer is that in humans, our deep subconscious pleasure drives are overlaid with lots of learning and social acculturation and lots of complication. So it turns out that we have this pleasure circuit in the medial forebrain, and it's evolutionarily very ancient. So we share it with animals like lizards and snakes, and in truth, even animals that don't even have a proper brain, like roundworms, have a rudimentary pleasure circuit. So if a roundworm is wriggling through the soil and eats a particularly tasty clump of bacteria, its dopamine neurons will become active in a rudimentary pleasure response. So this pleasure circuit evolved so that we would find eating food and drinking water and having sex to be pleasurable so that we would survive and pass our genes on to the next generation. So if I were to have you right now in a brain scanning machine and you were eating a bite of food when you were hungry, we would see these regions of the brain become active. And likewise, if you were having an orgasm in the machine, and this is something that that actually has been done in laboratories, similarly, these regions of your brain would become active. And what has happened is that this evolutionarily ancient pleasure circuit has been artificially activated by things like nicotine and alcohol and heroin and cocaine. We figured out how to short-circuit the pleasure regions.
And that short-circuiting is different how? It's still the same experience. It is just different how we got there.
Well, I think the thing we have to realize is that pleasure, activation of these neurons, is sort of the final common property of pleasure. So we don't need brain scanners to know that eating food and making love and having runner's high don't just feel all alike. In other words, they share a certain pleasurable component, but they're very different experiences. They're overlaid with different associations, and the quality of the pleasure is not identical. But they do share activation of this medial forebrain pleasure circuit in common. So we shouldn't be left with the idea that all these experiences are just identical because they share this part of the brain being active. They're not, and we know that we know that from our experience in the world. But what it does mean is that all of these different things that cause dopamine release within the brain's pleasure circuitry share a certain rewarding, pleasurable sensation, and they make us want to repeat the kinds of activities that lead to this. And as a consequence, if you engage in these behaviors over and over again, a fraction of us will have changes in that pleasure circuitry, actual electrical, physical, and chemical changes that can result in addiction.
The pleasures that you feel and what is going on, I just want to make sure I have this right. So of what's going on in the brain, so if that is caused by, as you say, the short-circuiting of whether it be cocaine or heroin versus an orgasm, what's basically scientifically going on in the brain is the same?
Well, no, they share something in common.
Okay.
So in other words, if I were to show you a complete pattern of activation of your brain while you're having an orgasm, and the complete pattern of activation of your brain while you were a moment after you injected heroin, they would not be identical, but they would overlap. And the key place they would overlap is that they would both show activation of the brain's pleasure circuitry. So obviously, if you're having an orgasm, one of the things that is happening is that certain parts of your body, probably your genitals, are being stimulated. So the part of your brain that processes sensory information from your genitals is going to be activated along with your brain's pleasure circuitry. If you are just after shooting heroin, the part of your brain that's processing sensory information from your genitals would not be activated, but the pleasure circuitry would be activated. So they overlap, but they're not identical.
When I think one of the most fascinating things about the book, and as I mentioned in the introduction, is that what you talk about is that in the future it may be possible to activate our pleasure circuits at will. So how could we do that?
Well, right. So this is getting into the far future of science fiction right now. So we know, for example, from laboratory animals and from a small number of humans who've undergone electrode emplacement in neurosurgery, that if you actually stick an electrode into someone's brain and you lodge the tip of the electrode within the pleasure circuitry and you activate it artificially, that they can feel an intense pleasure and that those people love that. And if you give them a button to self-stimulate the pleasure circuits of their brain, they'll do it over and over and over again. And a rat will do the same, or a mouse, or a monkey. Right now, though, in order to do that, you have to drill a hole in the skull and you have to implant an electrode in the brain. And obviously, that's not the sort of thing that one is going to do recreationally. It's major surgery with lots of risks. Right now, if you want to activate the brain from without sticking in electrodes or without making holes in the skull, the techniques that we have to do that are very, very crude. They don't activate single neurons or even little groups of neurons. They activate many cubic centimeters of tissue all together, and they most effectively activate those parts of the brain that are closest to the surface. So right now, things like electroconvulsive shock or transcranial magnetic stimulation that are used therapeutically for depression relief that is refractory to drugs, or in certain kinds of motor rehabilitation following injury. Those things are very crude means of activating the brain. However, if one imagines a future where we have a non-invasive, you know, imagine a baseball cap that you could slip on your head and could non-invasively activate very small groups of neurons in your brain with high temporal fidelity, then one of the things that could be done would be to activate the pleasure circuit artificially with great precision. And if that were to happen, then we societally have to make some decisions about how we're going to regulate that. Are we going to regulate that like heroin or cocaine? Are we just going to let people do that whenever they want? If that were available to everyone, kind of like Woody Allen's Orgasmatron from that old movie, Is that something we would leave alone, or we would want to control?
And I assume we would want to control it, wouldn't we?
Well, you know, these are decisions that we as societies have to make. In the past, I would say we've done a rather poor job of regulating psychoactive substances. We have a situation where tobacco is legal. 80% of all people who smoke cigarettes become cigarette addicts, and cigarette use is ultimately lethal, and yet that is legal, whereas cannabis is a drug that basically can't kill you. You can't overdose on it, and yet we have it illegal in most places. So I can't say that I trust that we as a society always make good rules for regulating things that activates the brain's pleasure circuit. So far, we've made a bit of a hash of it.
When you look at the causes of addiction, of what makes us do the next step, how do we then, in the meantime, control it? I mean, you talk in the book of fast food restaurants that basically guarantee that people will eat more. So how do you then counter that? What do we have in our arsenal that is able to combat that?
Right. Well, so that's a great question. And so I think to answer requires backing up just a little bit and making the point that about 40% of the variation in propensity for addiction we inherit from our parents. So there's about 40% of that can be explained by genetics. And the remainder is accounted for by one's summated life experiences, actually starting in utero while you're in your mother's womb and continuing throughout your life. And we don't understand entirely how that works, but one of the things that we certainly do know is that life stress is a very important determinant of whether one will become an addict, or if one is in recovery, whether one will relapse. And you might think, oh, stress, that's a very kind of vague psychological concept. He's veering away from biology now. But actually, we know a lot about the biology of stress. So if you're sacked from your job, or if you're fighting off a viral infection, or if you have an argument with your sweetheart, all of those things cause your adrenal glands, which sit on top of your kidneys, to secrete stress hormones. And those stress hormones pass into your bloodstream and into your brain, and they bind receptors on neurons. And some of those neurons are in your brain's pleasure circuitry. And that act of those stress hormones binding receptors on those pleasure circuitry neurons set in motion a series of biochemical changes that cause you to crave. So what does all this biochemistry mean for you in practice in your life? Well, what it means is that if you are trying to avoid developing addictions, or if you're in recovery and you're trying to stay clean, one of the very best things you can do is to engage actively every day in stress reduction strategies, whether that's playing with your dog or your child, or meditating, or prayer, or exercise. These things are stress reducers, and they also themselves activate the brain's pleasure circuit in a way that is moderate and sustainable.
You actually have a great quote from Jeff Tweedy, who is of Wilco, who wrote our theme song, among many other wonderful accomplishments. But he, to counter all of that in his addictions, found exercise. Then he was running so much, and then he got these stress fractures in his legs, and he said, you have a quote in here, he said, you know, once you're an addict, you're always an addict, so just because I found something good to do doesn't mean I'm not going to hurt myself doing it.
Right. Well, so yeah, I mean, I love that quote, and you know, my heart's out to Jeff Tweedy and his long struggle with painkillers and alcohol and other things, and obviously he's done the right thing. I don't want your listeners to be left with the idea of saying, all right, well, you know, I'm not going to give up my chemical addictions for exercise because I'll just become an exercise addict.
Well, I like your idea with the dog.
Good. That's a great thing to do.
Yeah, the dog idea is great. The name of the book is The Compass of Pleasure, How Our Brains Make Fatty Foods, Orgasm, Exercise, Marijuana, Generosity, Vodka, Learning, and Gambling Feel So Good. It's published by Penguin. Dr. David Linden, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, The Compass of Pleasure, published by Penguin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.